Hello, listener of the Third Sector podcast. This is Lucinda, and you're about to listen to episode 5 of The End of Charity, our 6-part documentary exploring the future for doing good. I hope you enjoy it.
My background's in crime reporting. When you get down to any kind of sexual abuse or child sexual abuse, that's the first thing you see. It's the power imbalance, be it the priest or the swimming coach or the aid worker. They have power. It's an abuse of power and abuse of trust.
You're listening to The End of Charity. I'm Lucinda Rouse. And in this episode, we tackle one of the biggest and most pervading challenges facing the voluntary sector. Power.
I always knew it was a significant story because you were dealing with Oxfam. You were dealing with a great British institution. It was a household name.
Who holds it? Who exercises it?
It was very much part of the fabric of our society. I think, you know, there's an Oxfam shop on every high street.
And what happens when the balance is distorted?
It was going to be a huge story.
On the 12th of January 2010, a catastrophic magnitude earthquake struck the Caribbean country of Haiti. The Haitian government published an official death toll of more than 300,000 people. It made the earthquake's aftermath one of the worst natural disasters in recorded history. It was estimated that around 3 million people were affected by the quake, nearly a third of the country's total population.
Relief agencies around the world are scrambling to get hundreds of tons of emergency supplies to Haiti. It's not just food parcels, tents and medicines, but heavy lifting gear, communications equipment, and here from Oxfam's huge Bicester warehouse, everything that's needed to set up emergency water supplies.
Relief organisations from around the world moved quickly to deliver aid in the aftermath of the disaster, including Oxfam. Through public donations, Oxfam managed to raise more than £60 million to fund their response. The charity said it reached over 500,000 people, with a further 700,000 helped by its cholera prevention programme. But behind the scenes, something very dark was unfolding.
In 2018, I was the chief reporter at the Times, and we broke the story of Oxfam's cover-up, as I insist on calling it, of sexual misconduct by senior aid workers in Haiti.
Sean O'Neill is a senior writer and former crime editor at the Times newspaper. The most senior aid worker in question was Oxfam's country director in the earthquake disaster zone, Roland Van Hauwemeyren.
The strongest allegation was that he had paid a young Haitian woman for sex. And sometimes it wasn't a case of paying with money. It was paying with goods and services, I think, especially nappies and baby food and things like that.
Sean's investigation first revealed sexual misconduct in 2011 during the Haiti disaster response. But this was by no means an isolated incident. Shortly after his initial story broke in February 2018, that's more than 7 years after the abuse occurred, Oxfam was hit with fresh allegations that employees had used sex workers in Chad in 2006. Van Hauwemeyren was running operations in Chad at the time. In the following weeks, further allegations surfaced against Van Hauwemeyren that related to a separate posting with the health charity Merlin in 2004 in the Liberian capital Monrovia, where aid was pouring in to help the country recover from a decade and a half of devastating civil war.
I thought, everybody knows this is going on. This is well known. There was a Swedish official who said she was talking about Liberia and something that Van Hauwemeyren had done when he worked for Merlin years before. And she'd reported him and nothing had been done about him. She said the behaviour at that time in Monrovia was insane, but plenty of UN types were doing the same. Lots of sleazy bars, girls on the beach. And a whistleblower subsequent to the Haiti story breaking had told me that he had been for dinner with Van Hauwemeyren in a Monrovia restaurant. And when dinner finished, he and his colleagues had said, right, now time for desserts. And desserts meant going to nightclubs and picking up sex workers. In Chad, there were allegations of aid for sex. You know, everybody knew about this and it was allowed to carry on.
We When the Times broke the story of the Oxfam scandal in 2018, it rocked the voluntary and not-for-profit world. The perception of the charity sector, both globally and domestically, was shaken. At this point, Van Hauwermeiren and five other staff had already left Oxfam after an internal investigation carried out in 2011 found them guilty of bullying and abuse of power. But it wasn't until Sean's story broke almost 6.5 years later that the UK Charity Commission launched a statutory inquiry and the consequences were felt. Oxfam GB's chief executive Mark Goldring and his deputy Penny Lawrence both resigned in the months after the scandal broke, and the UK government temporarily suspended aid funding to the charity. In the immediate aftermath of the allegations, it lost thousands of donors. We did ask Oxfam to participate in this series. They declined the opportunity to be interviewed, but they sent us this statement. All forms of sexual abuse are abhorrent and an affront to our values. We have worked hard to learn the lessons of the past, improve our safeguarding, and address wider imbalances of power. We are pleased that our progress has been recognised by the Charity Commission, but we know that no organisation can ever say that it is free of the risk of abuse. We are committed to continue doing all we can to ensure that our work takes place in as safe an environment as possible. The biggest questions to come out of the Oxfam scandal were, how could this happen? How could the abusive behaviours of those aid workers in some of the world's most vulnerable places be left unchecked? And what does it say about the degree of power that staff belonging to typically Western relief organisations can hold over the communities that they exist to serve, particularly in developing countries and the global south? Of course, we're not suggesting that every international aid worker abuses their position to such a degree. Far from it. But if you think back to some of the reflections on the history of charitable and philanthropic work earlier in the series, and start to follow the threads back to the origins of charity, the creation of an environment where abusive behaviours are allowed to thrive has a lot to do with power and how it is held.
If I am a community member and I know that all solutions come from this white person that comes from elsewhere, when they come in, immediately I'm going to receive them. Now, they already come in from a powerful position of where I'm ready to receive. And that in itself begins to distort the power balance.
This is Chilande Kulubu-Waria. She's the founder of Warande Advisory Centre in Kenya and supports NGOs around the world.
If they have all the solutions to my problems, who am I to tell them when I'm uncomfortable? Who am I to refuse when they call me into the room? Who am I to say something when I feel violated? Let me say I'm a child and I run to an elder and I talk to them. First and foremost, I'm afraid to talk to them about this issue because chances are the elder will say, shh. You know, you're spoiling for us. The cultures are often so disempowering to the more vulnerable communities like the children and women. It's a perfect environment for this to continue to happen for a long time.
Chilande has done a lot of deep thinking about the power of storytelling as both a cause and solution to the root injustices in the international aid system. She believes centering everything around money and how it is spent is a big part of the problem. And it's something that opens the door to abuses of power.
How we depict some of our continents is that this is a space of a lot of corruption. This is a space where there's abject poverty. People are always in this scarcity mentality so that when you give them money, they'll be looking to put it in their pockets. So that when the funder then comes in, the first thing is due diligence. Can you manage this money? And show me that you can manage this money. And during that whole process, I must keep coming to check, are you doing this? Are you doing it right? Are you using my money well?
Philanthropy and charity has become quite top down. So it's about the donor saying, this is what I think is important and what I want to be done with my money. And often that will come along with stipulations about precisely what the money can or can't be spent on or requirements to measure it in a particular way.
Our resident philanthropy expert, Rodri Davis. The idea he presents about donor power resonates with Chilande's own experience of working in the sector.
I remember working within an international NGO once, and my director at the time, she was American, she kept on reminding us, this is my money. I'm a taxpayer. This is my money. This is my brother's money. This is my sister's money. And we would go and think, oh, you think all sorts of things in your head. They're all coming to me in my mother tongue, so I don't want to say them. But you're thinking, all right, fine, I get it. so now what do we do with that piece of information, right? It's here now. But you live in this space where you're continuously feeling like a beggar. I have to beg. I have to prove my worth. I must show you that indeed I am worthy. Whereas you should understand that it is, you know, your privilege to be working with some of these communities. It's very undignified to receive funding and have all these conditionalities that are put around this particular funding pot. And it all comes from the narratives that people have, the biases, the stereotypes.
Chilande believes it's these biases which are creating the conditions for exploitation.
The person who's asked to be transparent is only the one who's receiving the funding, right? So it has centered where the money comes from rather than, you know, the communities that we're trying to support. And that's fundamentally the problem with just the funding relationships and the funding ecosystem as a whole. It really distorts our ability to achieve equitable partnerships. It's really skewed our ability to have dynamic accountability. And when there's no that accountability, it leaves a lot of room for mischief. And mischief does happen across the board.
Some working in the charity sector believe this total lack of dynamic accountability, as Chilande describes it, and the expectation on people living in the global south to prove they are capable of handling funding dates back to colonialism and the colonial origins of charity work.
When we look at the colonial project and missionaries and how missionaries were going out into places in the global south, Africa, etc., and spreading the good word about how people should be living. So already we have that kind of paternalistic approach to, I know what is good for you, I know what is the best, our God is the correct God, and all of your kind of knowledges, your spirituality is backwards, right?
This is Martha Awajobi. We spoke to Martha earlier in the series when she gave her verdict on Mr. Beast's philanthropy. I asked for her reaction to the Oxfam scandal.
I don't see organisations like Oxfam, MSF, like Reuters Foundation, Bill Gates Foundation as any different, really, from organisations like the Royal Africa Company, like the East India Trading Company. I see them as part of this imperialist project, as part of this project of colonialism. So I'm not shocked in the slightest. When we look at historical figures like Edward Colston, Robert Dundas, who, you know, were philanthropists, who were giving money to schools, to libraries, and like really being seen in our country as these philanthropic, benevolent beings, and at the same time were prolific slave traders. It comes back to how good deeds can be used as a mask for exploitation and can be used as a cover for abuses of power. I mean, it's not just, you know, Oxfam. It's happening all over the place. I don't think that we should be looking at this organization. I think we should be looking at, what does this say about international development as a whole? International development creates the conditions for that exploitation to happen. But I think often we'll be like, oh, it's international development, like they are the bad guys. Actually, it's the entire charity sector. It's, you know, the national charity sector. It is the way that power operates within our sector. You know, if we take a holistic approach, we should be looking at funders. We should be looking at international development. We should be looking at national charities. We should be looking at government grants. We should be looking at the charity commission as well, and seeing it as a kind of wider ecosystem that creates the conditions for exploitation, for power hoarding, for, you know, yeah, abuses of power. I'm not saying that they're doing no good work at all. I'm just saying, like, why is it that you are the ones there when there are people who understand the local context a lot better, who have already been doing this work for ages? And this is one thing I can't stand about charities.
Martha considers this power imbalance to be a problem for charities operating all over the world. So how has it played out closer to home? There have been a few incidents in the past 5 years. Back in 2019, a piece of training guidance from the information and advice charity Citizens Advice was widely criticised as horribly racist on social media. The guidance included a section on barriers we find in Black Asian and minority ethnic communities. These barriers included an intrinsically cash-centric culture, a society that revolves around religious belief, a distrust of British authorities, and evidence of gender bias and discrimination. It prompted a spate of conversations about race and racism in the sector. The following year, after the murder of George Floyd at the hands of a white police officer, there was a significant wave of UK charities openly acknowledging the structural racism within their own organisations and the wider sector. Over the same period, Third Sector was contacted by numerous whistleblowers at big-name charities who were reporting institutionally racist cultures within their own organisations. And what about the makeup of the sector as a whole? Data that tracks the diversity of the UK charity sector is limited and not exactly inspiring. Research published in 2023 found that 29% of the biggest charities have all-white trustee boards, compared with 4% at FTSE 100 businesses. And in 2022, it was estimated that just 9% of the UK charity workforce comes from a minoritised background. Partly in response to this, there's been a lot of consideration given to the need to include people with lived experience in charity management decision-making, wherever they are in the world. Here's Rodri.
If we think about that power imbalance between individuals or organisations that have quite a lot of resources and those that don't, one of the ways that we can try and rebalance things a bit maybe is by thinking about how you can bring the people or the organisations that would traditionally have been seen as the recipients of charity into the decision-making about how the money's spent.
Martha feels there's still a very long way to go.
I mean, I would say that if you look at where decisions are made, you know, who's sitting on boards, who gets to decide how the strategic direction of our charity sector, like you can see it happening in government, you can see it happening in foundations, you can see it happening in the leadership of these large organisations who are so far removed from the real kind of day-to-day struggles of the people that they claim to be there in service of, even though I don't love that language at all. But the people, you know, that they claim to care about.
Lots of charities have set up structures through which people with lived experience can have a say in how funding is spent in a bid to be more democratic and equitable. But why not go a step further and bring those recipients into the upper echelons of charity management? It's something that advocacy charity Freedom From Torture is prioritising as a central pillar of its work. Kolbasia Hausu is a torture survivor and now the charity's director of survivor leadership and influencing.
I came from Chad after fleeing torture to the UK in 2005. My relationship started with Freedom From Torture as a client. I went through services, you know, the therapy services for a period of 4 years. And from 2009, I started volunteering. In 2012, I became an employee. And then I became manager, and now I am one of the senior manager at Freedom From Torture. I definitely said I am an anomaly in the sector. One of my motives as well is to really to push for the sector to see people of lived experience as an asset, not just a group of vulnerable people, but people that really can help shape, you know, the sector. For a very long time, I would say that I was the only one that really advocating hard about the lived experience-centered approach and pushing organization really to have people that, you know, they're here to serve, you know, central to influencing them and help them change, you know, the system that they need to change. But still, quite a lot of organization right now, even the big organization within the refugee sector and also within the torture rehabilitation sector, still not having people lived experience in a leadership position.
Kolbasia has worked at Freedom From Torture since 2009. He has been instrumental in building the charity's survivor activism and making sure survivors are centred in all aspects of the organisation. He also co-founded a support network called Survivors Speak Out and has spoken at the UN Human Rights Council and at the Global Summit on Sexual Violence in London, as well as standing alongside Freedom From Torture ambassadors Angelina Jolie and William Hague to call for better international frameworks to eradicate torture. Kolbasi's contribution to the cause is undeniable, but he is, as he says, an anomaly. So why is it that even organisations with a stated intention to increase the representation of people with lived experience are failing to act on that resolve, or taking action in ways that are ultimately tokenistic?
I think it's tied a little bit of maybe unconscious bias or unconscious stigma. Because you see those people lived experience, you see them most of the time in the most vulnerable position, the most lower position that they can be. And when people are vulnerable, I think sometimes they don't come across confident, they don't come across pushing forward, you know, ideas, they don't come across throughout. They think that people just want to be in that position, not understanding that there is resilience that people build.
Vulnerability. That's a word that Chilande used earlier. Being a vulnerable recipient of charity increases your potential for exploitation by bad actors, even predators within the sector. And on the flip side, being vulnerable reduces the potential for those on the receiving end of charity to become a more active part of the system overhaul that is so vital to correct the power imbalance. I asked Kolbasia what needs to happen to see more people with lived experience rising up the ranks in the way he did at Freedom from Torture.
We need really to understand that people that we there to serve have expertise which is really essential for us in order to support them. And as long that we think that we are the group of experts, that we know everything, and then every solution fit everyone, then we're going to be having those challenges. And also secondly, I think we need to create a space which allow people with lived experience kind of to grow in the role. And also then we create a space for them to go through the ladder in order to be in a position of leadership. We need to put resources around it, and we need to structure it, and we need to protect it in order to happen. One thing that needs to happen is commitment. Second thing is resources. And also really understanding that, you know, we need to share the power. I believe that my voice has a power. And I believe that if I use my voice for the greater good, I can change quite a lot of things that are around, you know, around me.
Kolbasia lays out what he believes needs to happen to transfer power in charities. But is the system already creaking into action? Here's Chilande again.
Things have changed now, right? With the idea of being more inclusive with voices and being a lot more balanced with our narratives, all these are progressive movements towards getting us to start to clean up the sector. So we are beginning to see some of those narratives begin to change, and people begin to have a lot more open-mindedness in how and who brings in support, who is termed to be an expert, because back in the day, an expert had to be international and had to be white.
Listening to Chilande talk is a pretty optimistic and hopeful experience. It's a start, but there is a long road ahead. She herself has to take time out of her working day to convince her colleagues and stakeholders that she's actually capable of doing her job.
Every time I wake up, I've got projects I'm running in Bangladesh. I do understand that I have to take some time to prove my worth a lot more than my white counterparts would, that they can receive me. So those things are still there. And so we still need to put more effort in changing narratives, depicting differences, diversity of our people, in order for us to get to that space where it doesn't matter. My fear is that this becomes another fad. I hope this is not just another fashionable thing that we are discussing right now. Right now, we want to do this, and I'm hoping that people don't get tired of questioning, of having conversations. I'm liking the direction, I'm liking the introspection. I still think we need to go a little bit deeper in having the uncomfortable conversations. I hope that we can get to a space of bravery where we can sometimes get to that point and say, you know what, if I must lose myself, my dignity, my soul, in depicting myself in that way, it's okay.
So how does Martha feel this process of introspection is going?
There are pockets of the sector now that are engaging with ideas around white supremacy and colonialism, but it was almost impossible to even get leaders to admit that racism existed in their organisations. Racism is baked into the foundations of everything, our entire kind of political system, our charity system, the way we think, what we value, what's important to us. So I think that we need a million different approaches in a million different ways, like bearing in mind that like we're asking individuals to change. Individuals interact differently. They approach things differently. Some people need art. Some people need humor. Some people need visual. Some people need to read. Some people, you know, need to actually face consequences, actually experience accountability.
Let's go back to where we started our exploration of power, in the disaster zone in Haiti.
A lot of the aid workers involved in this, with the exception of Van Harmaren, they weren't wealthy Westerners. But in terms of their countries and regions they were working in, they had money and they had control over aid and they had privilege compared to the people who were living with hunger and earthquake and disaster. That's why they were able to do what they were able to do. I mean, they have power. It's an abuse of power and abuse of trust.
Is the modern charity model broken? We've looked at lots of arguments in the last five episodes. And this is surely an area where all concerned could be doing better. Because if the sector can't break away from abuses of power within its own walls, how can it hope to genuinely change the inequalities, oppressions, and abuses of power in our society?
I think that charities in general need to have a real kind of reckoning with their identities, like actually, like, what are we trying to do? What would it mean to achieve mission? And really go back to that, like, what is our mission? And if we were to achieve that in 10 years, what would we be doing? And if we can't achieve that in 10 years, who could do that? But there is no clear answer for me, you know, like, I don't know, I don't have the answers, and I don't think people should expect me to have the answers. I think we should all be coming up with our answers together because we've all got skin in the game. It's not like charity, so why, or like XYZ people of color who should really be setting the direction for this. White supremacy was created by white people. If that means that it can be undone in part by white people, it won't all be white people. It needs all of us coming together and building bonds of solidarity with each other and realizing how important it is and pressing it is for us to dismantle capitalism, imperialism, and white supremacy, because our entire ecosystem depends on us making that choice as well.
Next time, in the final episode of The End of Charity, we'll look over all the pieces of this puzzle and ask, what's next for the charity sector? The End of Charity is brought to you by Third Sector, the UK's leading title for the voluntary and not-for-profit sector. It was written and presented by me, Lucinda Rouse, and edited by Emily Burt. The producer was Ollie Peart at Rethink Audio. And special thanks to Rebecca Cooney, who devised the original concept for the series. We hope you've enjoyed listening so far. And if you have enjoyed the series, there are three simple ways that you could support us. Firstly, you could spread the word to others who might be interested in The End of Charity but haven't found us yet. And if you'd like to go the extra mile, leaving a positive rating or review on your preferred podcast platform would really help us. We'd love to hear your feedback on the series. Thank you for listening.